From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Ken Tucker, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, country music singer Tanya Tucker. She's been a star since the age of 14 and has brought a rowdy woman sensibility to country music. She's just released her 30th album called Complicated, and she has a new autobiography called Nickel Dreams. She talks about her hits, her misses, and her tabloid romances. Also, murder, midlife crisis, and searching for the perfect wave. Writer Kem Nunn talks about his 25 years on a board and how he makes surfing the stuff of literary fiction. His new novel is The Dogs of Winter. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The judge presiding over the Oklahoma City bombing trial has denied a request by the news media to make the jury selection process more open. U.S. District Judge Richard Mache has denied a request from news organizations that he stop holding closed conferences with attorneys to decide which jurors should be dismissed. Mache said that other potential jurors might be influenced by news reports disclosing the reasons why members of the jury panel were excused. He said he would unseal the transcripts of the conferences at a later date. This is the fourth day of jury selection in the trial of Timothy McVeigh. A U.S. Navy petty officer is under investigation in Japan on suspicion of assaulting a Japanese woman. No charges have been filed against him yet, but both American and Japanese authorities are looking into the matter. From Tokyo, NPR's Julie McCarthy reports.
A 26-year-old Navyman is in the brig at Yokosuka Air Base being held for questioning. The facts surrounding the case are conflicting. U.S. officials in Japan say the woman, a 21-year-old Japanese national, is alleging sexual assault. Base security answered a call for help early Wednesday morning and found the woman in the bachelor enlisted quarters injured. She had suffered a broken collarbone, contusions, and abrasions. The Japanese police have yet to speak with the U.S. serviceman, but they report no allegation of sexual assault, but rather assault with bodily injury. The case could aggravate U.S.-Japan relations and comes at a delicate time. Prime Minister Ryutaro Hashimoto is trying to push through Parliament a law that would force landowners to continue leasing their land to the U.S. military after leases expire in May. In Tokyo, this is Julie McCarthy.
Senior Palestinian officials say President Clinton must get Israel to stop building Jewish settlements for the peace process to resume. But Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said again today that he would not freeze settlement construction in the West Bank or in disputed East Jerusalem. Israel has dropped its request for the U.S. to extradite a suspected Palestinian militant. NPR's Eric Weiner has that story.
U.S. immigration officials detained Musa Abu Marzouk at a New York airport in 1995. He is allegedly a top official with the radical Islamic group Hamas, a group responsible for several terrorist attacks against Israel. Israeli officials originally wanted the U.S. to extradite Marzouk to stand trial in Israel, but now they have dropped that request, citing security concerns. Israeli officials were clearly worried that extraditing Marzouk might lead to more terrorist attacks. There is speculation that the alleged militant might now be extradited to Jordan. Abu Marzouk, a U.S. resident for the past 15 years, denies that he was involved in any terrorist attacks. This is Eric Weiner in Jerusalem.
On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 24 points in active trading. On the NASDAQ, the composite index is up nearly 7 points. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, blue chip issues are leading today's further retreat on Wall Street, but the broader market has been down and has now started to rebound a bit. More from Bloomberg's Doug Krisner.
The market is being buffeted by concern about corporate profits after the Wall Street Journal reported that several analysts lowered earnings expectations for IBM. Investors are also reacting to comments from Fed Vice Chair Alice Rivlin, who told Reuters Television the economy did not slow as expected during the first quarter. She added that growth is very strong with the risks of accelerating inflation. Rivlin also said she's not sure the recent decline in stocks will slow consumer spending. These remarks suggest Rivlin is in favor of another increase in interest rates. The argument for higher rates was supported by news of a larger-than-expected increase in housing completions during February. I'm Doug Krisner.
The government of India is asking that country's army to help move essential goods after more than 2 million striking truck owners kept their rigs off the roads for a third straight day. The strike has severely hit the movement of goods on roads and through ports and air cargo terminals, and business leaders in India say the strike could affect the entire economy if it continues much longer. Federal regulators are ready to clear the way for the biggest industry advance since color television, cinema-quality digital TV. The agency's plan calls for making the new technology available to consumers within the next 2 years. By the year 2006, broadcasters will no longer transmit programs in analog, so consumers will either have to buy a new digital TV or a device that enables them to receive the new signals on their old sets. Digital technology will enable TV stations to cram more services onto the airwaves. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations. Contributors include the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting public understanding of technology, industry, and economic growth.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Ken Tucker, Fresh Air's pop music critic and critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. Today I'm filling in for Terry Gross. My guest Tanya Tucker was a country music star at 14 years old, instantly distinctive for singing songs about madness, passion, and despair in a little girl's growl. Unlike a lot of child stars, however, she didn't fade away. Instead, Tucker has remained a central figure in country music into adulthood, altering her image in the 80s to include rock and roll and spandex, racking up hits as well as inches in the gossip columns for celebrity friendships that have included Cher, Don Johnson, and Glen Campbell. These days, she's the mother of two children and recognized as the precursor to today's 14-year-old country superstar, Leanne Rimes. Tucker has just published her autobiography called Nickel Dreams, written in collaboration with a friend, Patsy Bale Cox, and she's just released a new CD called Complicated. Here's a little bit from the album, a cut called Love Thing.
Oh, I want to tell y'all about the love thing. Something to do with the heart, a sweet song crying way down deep. You gotta play it, baby. No way to stay it. It's a love thing. It's got no name. It's just a feeling inside. It's a full moon, a summer.
Tanya Tucker, welcome to Fresh Air. Hi.
Hello. How are you, Ken?
Fine, thanks. I guess we should say right off the top, you and I are not related.
That's right.
There's no Tanya Tucker. No, except for that.
Oh, shucks.
Except for that brief marriage we had in the late 70s, right?
That's true.
We'll leave that aside for now. It sounds from reading your book that from a very young age, you were the one who wanted to pursue a career in show business rather than being pushed by your parents. Is that true?
Absolutely. You know, that was my dream, to be a country singer. I've never thought or dreamed about being anything else, and it was, I guess it's kind of strange to know what you want to be at such a young age. But my dad saw that I had this dream, and so we sort of had the dream together, and we pursued it together.
And he ended up being your manager, and it seems, again, in reading the book, while he'd never had any great experience in show business, he comes off like a very smart, aggressive, protective guy in dealing with, you know, big-time concert promoters and record executives. What was it like to have your father as your manager?
Well, it's been a real blessing. I mean, not to say we don't have our good and bad times like any father and daughter, but it's just amazing. When I was writing the book with Patsy, some of the best times that I recalled, and some of the most, wonderful times to me was the early years of us trying to get started and going to Nashville when I was 9 the first time, and then the second time when I just turned 13, and of course recorded Delta Dawn in 1972.
Yeah.
And he's kicked a lot of doors down. He really has.
Probably literally.
Absolutely. And, He just turned 70 on March 23rd, his birthday, and of course my album Complicated came out that day, so it was kind of a coincidence that that would happen. But he's been with me all along, and he's my most trusted friend.
What was it like traveling around at such a young age when you were just starting out, before you were even signed to a record contract? I would imagine you didn't have a band. You were probably working with pickup bands that you would come to in each town. Is that right?
Exactly. I mean, we would go together, my dad and I, in a station wagon, and we would drive to different shows. And I think I was making around $600 a night.
Uh-huh.
So I had several number one records out, and I didn't have a band. And it was very difficult to get these musicians to listen to a 14-year-old kid.
I mean, I was going to say, how did you,
especially a girl?
Yeah, did you feel frustrated? Did you want to tell the band how you wanted your music played? What kind of accompaniment you wanted?
Absolutely, but of course, me, I really didn't have any musical background either. I mean, it was late. It kind of came later. I was in the junior high band. I played saxophone, but really, I never had any real formal training.
Mm-hmm.
So and my dad didn't have any training as far as getting into the business. I mean, we knew nothing about it.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, we've sort of been the fodders for the cannon, you know, with this new Leanne Rimes just came out about this year, and that's one thing I think she's got on her side. Besides being very talented, she's got her dad handling her career, and of course he's going to make some mistakes, we all do, but bottom line, he's going to be there for her every step of the way.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about her. I mean, she, Leanne Rimes, is really the same age you were when you hit it big. I mean,
exactly.
Do you see a lot of parallels with her career and yours?
I really do, and it sort of takes me back. I don't think everybody's wanting me to give her advice, but I really don't think she needs it. I think she's doing just fine. But I do see a lot of parallels, mainly that we got started at the same age. Our voices are a lot different, but you know, she's gonna be fine. I think she's got a very bright future ahead of her.
Yeah. At the same time, though, the country music industry has just changed so significantly in the times that you came along and she would come along.
Exactly.
I mean, she would never.
I'd like to hope that I paved the way a little bit for her. You know.
Yeah, I would think so. And I mean, she would never have to do the things you had to do early in the career. What we were just talking about, traveling around and with pickup bands and stuff. Do you think the industry has changed significantly in its attitudes toward child performers or a performer that comes right out of the box with a number one hit and what you have to do?
Yeah, I think it's changed totally, not just for child performers, but for everyone. I mean, there are so many people infiltrating, so many new artists infiltrating the business now. Sometimes it's a little hard to tell them apart, you know. But there's a lot of great music coming out of Nashville and a lot of great music coming out of country music. And it's where I thought it should always be years ago. I had this dream for country music, and not just for myself, but for the whole business of country.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes me feel really good, because from where I started out, it was a lot different, a lot more difficult. Not to say it's not difficult now, because it is. The reason it's more difficult now, though, is there's so much more saturation of artists than there was when I started. I mean, when I started out, there was not that many female singers, not that many country girl singers. It was Tammy and Loretta, and that was about it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so there wasn't a whole, not to say they weren't competition, because they certainly were two of the greatest of all times. But there wasn't a whole lot of us. And now women in country music are just exploding. I mean, it's just amazing. We're drawing the big ticket, and we're selling the platinum albums, and we've come a long way.
Yeah.
I like to think I've been a part of that, you know?
Well, yeah, you certainly have. I mean, and before you, women singers in country music tended to be very polite, demure, mannerly.
Yes.
I mean, you were
lots of ruffles and lace. And
yeah, exactly.
Big hair.
right. And you were really the first person to say, hey, you know, women can get rowdy too, and you know, have a good time. I mean, I think that was an important thing when you came along to establish. Did you feel at the time that you were doing something different? Did people say, hey, don't act like that?
They do that all the time.
Yeah, still today.
They say that all the time.
Yeah.
When you're in the middle of the storm, it's hard to feel the wind blowing, I think, sometimes. I mean, I'm just so inside of it that I don't think I really noticed that change that much. If I did, The first time I did was when I did the TNT album. I went to L.A. and I recorded the TNT album. And that was, everybody thought I'd gone rock and roll, which that wasn't my, absolutely was not my motive. My motive was to do basically what Garth did, is just spread my wings, and I wanted the world to hear country music, and I knew that if they were exposed to it, that they would love it. But my image sort of changed as far as people were concerned, the public, when I cut that TNT album and I did the fold-out thing. And
yeah, I remember. I vividly remember
in
that.
The red spandex
and the spike heels and the all that. It was in fact
the dynamite.
Right. I was living in L.A. at the time, and I remember a showcase that they had for you, I think at the Whiskey A Go-Go.
Right.
You performed there, and it was like
I think it was at the Roxy.
Oh, you're probably right.
It's the Roxy, yeah.
And it was a big deal, because it was like I was a rock critic at that point in L.A., and it was a big thing to get the rock press out and see you at that time. It was a real image change for you.
It really was, but it wasn't the one that I really wanted. I mean, I don't mind the image so much as the music I really didn't care for. I mean, it wasn't a good time for me, and I just wasn't in a good space at that time. And that's why Complicated, this new album, is so special to me, because it's my 30th album, and it's the first time I've worked with Greg Brown, which was a very big step for me to take, just because Jerry Crutchfield's been working with me for the last 13 albums.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you know Greg's record with Travis Tritt. He's recorded all those hits on Travis, so he's done a great job, and he let me be. He let me rock. You know. He let me. He gave me my reins, and that's exactly what I've been needing, is someone to give me the reins and let me go on with what I want to do.
Well, your first big hits were produced by the great Nashville producer Billy Sherrill.
That's right.
Who had worked with people like George Jones and Tammy Wynette.
You bet.
Was it intimidating to be 14 and working with what I would assume was a tough buzzard like him?
You know, it was absolutely wonderful.
Really?
We had a great relationship. And I look back over those times, and it really was quite something to have taken the chance to sign me. I mean, I was 12 years old when he signed me, and I turned 13, and we recorded Delta Dawn in May. I guess May 6th it came out was the release date on Delta Dawn when it hit the radio stations. And I had to really, really look back and think how wonderful that was, because I think if I would have fallen into the hands of someone else, that I wouldn't be here today.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he listened to me. He listened to a 13-year-old girl. And when I said, I don't think that Happiest Girl in the Whole USA is my song. I just don't think it's my kind of song.
Was that a song that was originally given to you to sing?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
So that became this big Donna Fargo hit.
Exactly.
That launched her career.
Absolutely. And we later, of course, became friends, and we discussed that, me and Donna.
Uh-huh.
But, of course, he played Delta Dawn for me, and I said, now that is my song.
I think that's amazing that at that young you would have that sense of yourself and the kind of material you should be doing.
Well, looking back over it, it's amazing to me, too, but not only that, but that he would listen to me.
Right.
You know, because here's this big major, I mean, everybody kept telling me, oh, Billy Sherrill, Billy. I didn't know who Billy, I didn't know a producer from Adam, you know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, I didn't know what they did.
Yeah.
So, but I kind of got, kind of caught on after a while that this guy was really incredible talent and really an icon in Nashville at that time.
I'd like to play a little bit from one of your earliest hits, Billy Sherrill produced. This is Would You Lay With Me in a Field of Stone.
Would you lay with me in a field of stone if my needs were strong? Would you lay with me? Should my lips grow dry, would you wet them, dear, in the midnight hour, if my lips were dry? Would you go away to another land, walk a thousand miles through the burning sand, wipe the blood away from my dying? If I give myself to you, will you bathe with me in the stream of life when the moon is full? Will you bathe with me?
That's Tanya Tucker, one of her earliest songs. That song, as well as Delta Dawn, dealt with some very mature themes. Can you remember how you related to those songs at the time, what you thought about when you sang the lyrics? Because that song, Will You Lay With Me in a Field of Stone, people criticized you for it was interpreted as the sexual nature of the lyrics.
Yes, they did. And it was banned on a few stations, but it still went to number one.
Really?
It was a number one record for me. So it was written by David Allan Coe, mm-hmm. and he was a strange bird.
Yeah, one of the original outlaws.
Exactly. And later it became a very good friend of mine and still is. But he walked in and he had like seven of his wives with him. and he played Billy the song. He sang it to him. And of course, after he left, I kind of went, ooh, that was a weird one, man, right there. Ooh. And Billy said, it's a great song, though. We're going to cut it. And we did. And, of course, we did get a lot of criticism. But David Allan Coe told me later that song he wrote as wedding vows for his brother's wedding. And I think when you listen to the song with that in mind, it changes it all around. It makes it something that's really, really strong. And it's the kind of love that, you know, I want to be loved like that. I think everybody does. Someone that would do those things for you has got to be someone that really loves you.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of a sexual connotation, it was more of a incredible, deep, emotional love, spiritual love, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, I could understand that when I was 15 when I recorded that song. So I could understand that. I mean, I came from a lot of love. I mean, I've never known how it would feel not to be loved. And that song really was very, 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 very strong. Very strong.
My guest is Tanya Tucker. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is country music singer Tanya Tucker. One person I didn't realize you'd been involved with until I read the book was Dolores Fuller, who's a very,
yes.
very colorful character. I mean, Dolores,
yes.
For people who don't know, Dolores Fuller wrote some of Elvis Presley's odder hits like Do the Clam.
And she was Roustabout.
Yeah, and she was the girlfriend of the cross-dressing bad film schlock director Ed Wood. How did Dolores Fuller enter your life?
Well, I was in Las Vegas, right outside of Las Vegas. My dad had purchased a place right outside of Las Vegas. And we were watching television one night, and an Elvis Presley movie came on, and her name was on the credits because she had written one of the songs. And he remembered that she lived in Las Vegas. And he said, you know, that woman lives here, and maybe we could get a hold of her. Maybe she could help us get a start. And I said, we'll call her up. And he said, well, she's probably not listed, but she was. We looked in the phone book, and he called her, and they got together, and she heard my tapes that I'd made. And I think at that, she had managed Johnny Rivers at one time, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So she was real heavily involved in the music and the acting and all that. And so we met, and she said, you've got to meet Billy Sherrill. And this is a guy we'd kept hearing about everywhere we went. You need to see Billy Sherrill. Well, we did send him a tape, but it got to return to us, so we figured he didn't even hear it. But he came to Las Vegas. She said he likes to gamble, so he should be coming here. And the day he came in, she called us and said, he's here. So we went down to the Riviera, me and my dad and my mother, and sat down with him. And I think Bobby Vinton was there and Al Gallico. And we sat in the little booth, one of those big booths there at the coffee shop, and he looked across the table and said, when do you want to cut a hit record? And I said, yesterday, man, yesterday. And so that was really basically what happened.
You saying?
And I went to Nashville, and I stayed there for 2 weeks, and that's when we found
Delta Dawn. The rest is history, yeah.
Yeah.
You say in the book that Fuller said that the way to package you was as, quote, a country music Lolita.
Yeah. She was really into, she wanted to push the sexy look and all that. I noticed they're starting to do a little bit of that with Leanne. I hope they don't take it overboard. But I know that I wasn't ready for that at that age. And
mm-hmm.
I my dad certainly wasn't going for it. So that caused a lot of problems between the two of them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm, you know, sticking with my dad no matter what. So I think a lot of times people thought they could take me away from him and change me and form me and shape me into something that they wanted me to be. But I wasn't going for it for that either.
Right.
So that caused a lot of problems with them and their relationship, and that's eventually why he let her go.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, that's exactly the take that she had. I just wasn't ready, mm-hmm. Personally and physically and mentally. You know,
sure.
I just was not ready for that. I wanted to get on stage and just make my music, and I didn't know what sexy was, you know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, I just, it wasn't me. I thought, that's going to come later. And, of course, you know, guess what?
It did.
Yeah.
It did with a vengeance.
Yeah.
I mean, I would imagine in writing this book that you had the opportunity to look back at the whole shape of your career and think about when and why you made certain decisions.
Yes.
I wondered if when you look back, can you pinpoint the time when you said, well, it's time to make the transition from teenage star to grown-up woman artist, and maybe there were different kinds of songs you wanted to record or change the way your records were produced at a certain point?
Well, I think that point was probably when I went to Jerry Crutchfield. I mean, I did a couple albums, one with Gary Klein out in L.A., one with Snuff Garrett, one with Michael Chapman, who, you know, was claim to fame as Blondie, Debbie Harry, and the mm-hmm. Knack, and Exile, these groups that were really rock and roll. So at that time, I got a little frustrated and went back to Nashville in about 84, 85, and cut another album with David Malloy for Arista, which was the first album, country album for Arista Records. And that didn't work out either because they weren't prepared for really country music at that time. Now they're one of the biggest record companies in Nashville. And I kind of got frustrated after that point with the whole thing. And at that point, I was grown up. And I did want to make some of my own decisions and my own moves and my own different songs, things. I had different ideas.
That's Tanya Tucker. Her autobiography is called Nickel Dreams. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Ken Tucker, and this is Fresh Air.
If all you want's a good time, baby, is a party down the street. If you're trying to find an old flame, well, I can't take the heat. If you're looking for a game to play, well, I wish you. All I have to offer you is love. If you only want a keeper, darling.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we meet novelist Kem Nunn, who dives into the subculture of surfing. And we continue our conversation with Tanya Tucker, who talks about her wild romance and sometimes abusive relationship with Glen Campbell. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. I'm Ken Tucker, sitting in for Terry Gross. We're continuing our conversation with Tanya Tucker, who has a new album called Complicated and an autobiography, Nickel Dreams. In the 80s, Tucker was riding out a rocky period that included sagging record sales and a stint at the Betty Ford Clinic. She'd also entered into a stormy relationship with Glenn Campbell. You write that you'd have these tremendous fights with him. You were both doing drugs. You'd stop and do cocaine and then start fighting again. These things were such epic. I mean, these sound like marathon sessions. And even though you're very specific about the violence involved, you say that he knocked your front teeth out in one fight.
Right.
Although I guess we should say he denies that.
Oh, God.
Well.
Oh, well. Someone had to knock him out. I mean, yeah. I don't have him for some reason.
Yeah, they're just
but,
not
you know,
there.
A lot of that, those are some of the difficult things that were hard to talk about because, you know, I really, really don't need to, I really, really don't want to hurt Glenn Campbell. And I mean, to me, he's been hurt enough and he's hurt himself enough. And mm-hmm. I just didn't want to be on that bandwagon. I care about him, and I want him to be happy. It was very difficult to write about personal things. I could have written a lot more, mm-hmm. but I don't figure that anybody's life is going to be bettered by it. And I think it should be between me and Glenn and the good Lord, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I really don't think, I feel like ratting on anybody.
Right.
And that was one of the difficult times for me in writing the book, is just trying to be careful, but being honest at the same time. And I wanted to be totally honest.
Yeah, well, that's what strikes me in reading the book is that, you know, everything gets, it's in the air now about that kind of physical abuse and that kind of thing.
But exactly.
This may be a politically incorrect question to say, but I wonder, when you're involved with somebody in a passionate way, isn't there a sense in which fighting almost becomes part of the love affair?
You know, it's true, especially when there's drugs and alcohol involved.
Mm-hmm.
It just becomes a real big cycle. And, we did, I have no doubt that we didn't really care about each other, but too many things were in the way. I mm-hmm. mean, too many things. And now I'm not going to sit here and tell you that if there were no drugs or alcohol involved, that he and I would have made it. But we might have made it a little longer, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just a time for me where I was coming into my own, and I was just becoming a grown woman, you know, at 22. And he'd been much twice my age. But I was certainly in awe of him, and I think it would be very dishonest to say I wasn't. He was a big hero to me, and one of the greatest singers I've ever known,
mm-hmm.
And one of the greatest musicians. So we had some bad times, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And I just hope I never have those kind of times again.
Mm-hmm. The new album, Complicated, what I particularly like about it is that it is more complicated, a more complicated picture of you, I think. Over the past few years, you've maintained this steady stream of hit singles, and there's been established this kind of identifiable Tanya Tucker sound, this kind of big, full production and songs that
right.
have lots of strong, positive emotions, even when it's a sad song. But on Complicated, you tackle some new styles, new tempos. Sometimes it sounds more rock and roll-y. Sometimes it's more stripped down, almost like folk music.
Exactly.
I'd like to play an example of this that I thought was a particularly good song on the album. This is a cut written by Harlan Howard and Costas.
Yeah, Costas.
Yeah, called I Don't Believe That's How You Feel.
How you feel? I don't believe that you don't love me. I guess I must have hurt you bad. I didn't mean to make you sad, and I sure regret the words I told you now. I don't believe that we're all through.
That's Tanya Tucker. That song has a real Tex-Mex style, and,
yes.
and yet it has this bridge midway through that's like something on an old Ray Price or Carl Smith record. you know, it's like a really, it's a very up-to-date song with a very old-fashioned feel to it.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, well, look at Harlan Howard. That's a perfect explanation of him. I mean, he's a great writer, but he's been around forever.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, he's a real character, isn't he?
Oh, he's such a character.
I mean, he's got this big shock of white hair, and
he's something else.
Yeah,
I've quoted him several times in my book about he always says I'm a writer trying to get out of a singer's body.
uh-huh.
And then someday we're going to have to write a song together. But I was elated because it was one of the first songs I've cut of Costas, mm-hmm. which is also, he was also a wonderful writer. And the first song I've cut of Harlan since I was 14.
Really?
I cut a song called The Choking Kind on my Watch Your Mama's Name album.
The Choking Kind, what a great title.
Yeah, oh, it's a great song. And that's the last time I'd cut a Harlan Howard song. So I was ecstatic because we're such good friends. And I told my producer, Greg, I don't want to know who wrote anything. I just want to hear the songs because I have so many friends that are writers. I was afraid I'd be swayed, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I recorded the songs and never knew who wrote them. So I found out that Harlan wrote that, and I was really, really elated. I loved that. I was so happy. But you're right. It's got a little Mexican feel to it. And you're right about all the songs. They're all just, they're all little parts of me, but they're totally different parts, different sides, I guess you might say.
Mm-hmm.
I love it. I love that, though. I think it's, I really don't like having an album that's just every song is, I mean, that's what the problem I have with listening to some other people's albums sometimes, some other artists, is that everything sounds the same.
Mm-hmm.
But I think this is a real eclectic album, and it's very diverse, and I like that. I like it. That's the way I am.
Uh-huh. How do you go about selecting or gathering songs for an album? Is there a kind of habit you have of, like, you know, getting a whole bunch of tapes and sitting down and listening to them? Or do you let just any songwriter who might be interested in pitching you a song do that? Or,
well, they have a publisher sheet, of course. You know, in Nashville, all the publishers are aware when you record and or when whoever's recording. They have a little artist sheet, and they I bet you, about 5,000 or 6,000 songs that Greg had to go through. The writers are, like I said, I've got a real, just a real love for songwriters, and they're most of them are friends of mine. I mean, that's really who I sort of hang with when I'm in Nashville, the publisher will come, they'll bring all sorts of songs. I'm always looking for songs. I've got tapes still in my house, in my office, that are just big boxes of tapes that someday I keep thinking I want to go through them. But I'm constantly looking for that hit song, that wonderful, perfect, Another Delta Dawn would be nice, you know. So it's a singer. I'm a singer always on the trail of a good song,
mm-hmm.
always. So, and there's other writers that want to write things for me. And so we never have any trouble finding material. It's almost the other way around.
Well, lots of older country stars like Waylon Jennings and George Jones have complained that country music is now a young person's game, that only, you know, attractive guys and gals in their 20s get played on the radio.
Yeah.
You're certainly not as old as those guys, and your music is certainly played on the radio, but do you think they're basically right in that criticism?
I think they're right in a way, but I see no reason why Waylon Jennings couldn't have a hit record today.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's a great singer. He's one of our icons. He's a legend. I love to hear him, and I think it's just material. I think that Merle Haggard should have a number one record right now. I think Loretta Lynn should have records out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these people, I think, have just been in the business so long, they're kind of tired,
mm-hmm.
and they kind of want to kick back.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's probably what's kept me going, is I'm still wanting it. I'm still wanting to be out here. I'm still wanting to do it. I'm still young enough to feel like doing it. Instead of complaining, Waylon, I think we ought to go over and give Waylon a hit. I think he can still do it, you know?
Right. Well, I think one of the problems...
But it's true, though, Ken. A lot of... They're just not playing the old...
Right. That's what I was going to say, was that, you know, even before, just when Leanne Rimes put out Blue, one of the things you heard was that the industry saying, that's too country.
Yeah.
This absurd situation where country radio doesn't want to play anything that's too country because it has to somehow appeal to, you know, aging baby boomers
generation.
And rock and roll fans and stuff like that.
Yeah.
They
can't forget there's a few of us out here that really like to hear that country.
Yeah, yeah.
I like it real country.
That's right.
But I like everything. I like everything from Jimmy Rogers to Frank Sinatra.
Uh-huh.
You know? And I think there's a lot of other people out there, too. And I think we always try to categorize things too much.
Yeah, I mean, everything gets too kind of marked, segmented, and directed at, you know, specific audiences and all that
exactly.
kind of thing.
Well, we'll come back around. Radio, you know, they're pretty smart. They'll get back around here.
Yeah, I mean, there's already this movement I keep hearing about called alternative country that's, you know, younger players doing very old-style honky-tonk country
exactly.
music.
Exactly, yeah.
I mean, that's the kind of stuff that I would think you want to hear more of.
Absolutely. Yeah. I love it.
Yeah.
I'm ready for it. I mean, we're always ready for new faces, and I love the new faces, but I love them old faces too.
Uh-huh.
And someone told me, they said, you know, have you ever thought about you are like part of the old and you're part of the new, but have you ever considered you might be a bridge between the two?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was the most beautiful compliment I've heard in my life.
Well, thank you so much for talking. It's really been great.
I love talking to you, Ken, and thanks so much. I hope I get to hang out with you again sometime.
Tanya Tucker. Her new CD is called Complicated. Her new memoir is Nickel Dreams, and this is the song that made her famous, Delta Dawn.
Delta Dawn, what's that flower you have on? Could it be a faded rose from days gone by? Take you to his mansion in the sky. She's 41 and her daddy still calls her baby. All the folks around Brownsville say she's crazy, 'cause she walks downtown with a suitcase in her hand, looking for a mysterious dark-haired man. In her younger days, they called her Delta Dawn, the prettiest one you ever laid eyes on. Then a man of low degree stood by her side, promised her he'd take her for his bride. Delta Dawn, what's that flower?
That's Tanya Tucker. Coming up, we meet a novelist who hangs 10, Kem Nunn. This is Fresh Air. Newsweek magazine, in reviewing Kem Nunn's new novel, The Dogs of Winter, called it the greatest novel ever written about surfing. Nunn himself calls his book a Gnostic surf fable. The novel proceeds from a classic kind of hard-boiled fiction premise. The protagonist, Jack Fletcher, is a middle-aged surfer and photographer whose life has gone sour. Divorce, booze, pills, a thoroughly botched career, now reduced to taking pictures at weddings, quote, as far inland as Pomona Valley, the land of the powder blue tuxedo. Fletcher gets a second chance in life when he's suddenly asked by a big surfing magazine to accompany three surfers in finding Heart Attacks, a secret spot on Native American land in Northern California. Fletcher's there to photograph the surfers as they try to conquer the giant Heart Attacks waves. But in the process, he also falls for the wife of one of the surfers and encounters violence and death. The Dogs of Winter is Kem Nunn's fourth novel. His first, 1984's Tapping the Source, also about surfing, continues to have a strong cult following. There are surf shops in California named after the book. Kem Nunn, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
As an admirer of both Dogs of Winter and Tapping the Source, I'm impressed by the fact that I find myself completely enthralled by a sport I have absolutely no interest in, which I take as a testament to your powers of description and pacing as a writer. What is it about surfing that interests you that makes it a subject rich enough to carry the weight and drama of a novel?
Well, you know, I don't know. It was something I grew up with, so it was a part of my life. And I still remember the first time I saw anybody surf. That was back in the days when you could still camp out on the beaches in Southern California. And I remember camping out with my family and another family, waking up in the morning and seeing these guys surfing at a place called Salt Creek. And it just, you know, I'd always loved the beach and loved the ocean. And when I saw somebody doing that, it just struck me that this is what these things were for. This is how you achieve some sort of communion with them. And so surfing became a part of my life at that time. And I don't know, that's part of the answer, I guess, that it was just part of my life and it was an important part of my life.
You have a real gift for being able to describe that sensation, the unique sensation, I think, of riding the waves and experiencing the waves. I wonder if I could ask you to read a description that occurs early on in the book that you have of the waves. It's on page 108.
Okay. Fletcher watched as the first wave of the set passed over the reef and began to break. At close quarters, it was an unnerving spectacle and yet a thing to behold, full of terror and fluid beauty. The amount of water involved was such that it was like watching a piece of the earth become liquid, as if in some cataclysm or at the hour of creation. The wave rose first with great mass, like a hill, but this hill was made of liquid in constant flux, and even as you watched it, it would change its form, turning itself to a long, dark wall as the face went vertical, and then beyond vertical as the crest began to feather, and finally to pitch forward, to strike the water far out in front of the face, thus creating the vaunted green room of surfing myth, the place to be if you were to be there at all, on a board at the eye of the storm, encompassed by the sound and the fury, bone dry in a place no one had ever been, or ever would be again, because when the wave was gone, the place was gone too, and would exist only in memory. Or perhaps, if the right person was there, in the right place, with the right equipment, it would exist on film, a little piece of eternity to hang on the wall.
That's Kem Nunn reading from his novel, The Dogs of Winter. In the new book, Jack Fletcher hooks up with these surfers that he's been hired to photograph, the two young guys who are sort of wild and sullen and rather stupid, and a slightly older man, a contemporary of Fletcher's who's in his 40s, Drew Harmon, who's a really fascinating character. You refer to him as the old lion, the holy ghost of professional surfing. I think at first the reader is kind of led to think that he's just a big blowhard and a bully. He's almost a caricature of an Ernest Hemingway kind of man. But as the book proceeds, we see that Harmon's a very intelligent guy with theories about everything. He's a surfing legend who's thought through the implications of the life that he's chosen. And it occurred to me that he's the man of action in the book, while Fletcher is an observer, much less of a hero, yet Fletcher's still the central character of the book. What were you trying to do with Harmon?
I've always been, like any subculture, you know, surfing has, there's a refrain that runs through the book about surfers, you know, loving their stories, particularly stories that revolve around, you know, big waves and outlaws, anybody who can stay old and somehow stay in the life. And that's, you know, not untrue of the culture at large, you know, the way we pick certain people and make heroes out of them for particular reasons. And often, you know, concentrating on the good things they've done and ignoring the rest of it, or sort of letting them slide with the things that they've done that perhaps aren't so good. And, you know, over the years, I would read, sometimes there would be profiles in surfing magazines about particular people who had, you know, managed in some way to stay in the surfing life, and they were, you know, this was all presented as very great, and yet if you knew a little bit more about the people, or if you're able even to read between the lines, you'd see that there really was another story there, you know, things that had been given up, things that had been sacrificed. So I was interested in writing a story and having this character who, you know, Jack Fletcher, the photographer, goes off in pursuit, really, of the legend, and what he discovers is the man beneath the legend. You know, he discovers the dark side of that myth, the price that this guy has paid for his, you know, status as a, you know, cult hero within this particular subculture. And but I think there's some sort of universal truths at play there, you know, at play there, at least I would like to think so. But that was, I think, the beginning of what intrigued me about him as a character.
Yeah, it's almost set up in a kind of Great Gatsby sort of way, in that Fletcher's the sort of Nick Carraway figure who's looking at the figure of Drew Harmon and, mm-hmm. and kind of analyzing him in that way and looking at him and turning him around in his mind. When at the start of the book, when Fletcher's offered the assignment, the magazine editor says to him, "We're going to find out if you're still the one or not." And it seems to me that at that moment, the book is set up as a kind of testing for Fletcher, for this guy who's had a pretty rocky life up till then. Do you think that's true, that the in a way the story is about testing Fletcher's character?
I think so. It's also, in a strange way, the book is a book about middle life for me, mm-hmm. about that passage from, as Jung called it, the night sea journey, you know, that passage from the first half of life into the second. And really all three male characters are sort of at that place, that, you know, that place that Jung also called the dead center, where you sort of have to figure out how to get from the first part to the next part. And so that's, in a way, that's really what's at stake for Jack Fletcher. I mean, the first part is over, and now he's got to sort of discover how to position himself for the rest of his life, for the second half of his life. So in that sense, it's a test, but it becomes a test quite different from the one that Michael Peters suggests at the beginning of the book. It becomes something, there's something more at stake than just, getting his name back on the masthead of a surfing magazine.
Novelist Kem Nunn. We'll be back in a minute. This is Fresh Air. We're talking to Kem Nunn, who's written a new novel called The Dogs of Winter. I'd be interested to know what you think of movies about surfing over the years, from those, you know, endless summer documentaries to movies like John Milius's Big Wednesday or Catherine Bigelow's movie Point Break. Have you seen any of those movies?
Yeah, I've probably seen all of them.
Uh-huh. Do you think they do surfing the sort of justice you would like them to do?
No, I think we have yet to see like a really good good movie that makes use of the surfing milieu. I mean, there again, it has to be, you know, the story has to come first. It has to be a great story played out against that particular milieu. Mm-hmm. You can't do it the other way around, which Hollywood often tries to do, not only with surfing but with any other sport, race car driving or, you know, whatever. They often, feel that the milieu or the sport is enough, and then the story takes, you know, second fiddle to that, and you wind up with something that's ultimately not really very good.
So Keanu Reeves in Point Break is not a convincing surfer for you?
Well, it's, you know, that is a kind of typical example of thinking, that's a kind of classic example of Hollywood thinking about surfing, is that, well, you can't just, the surfing alone won't be enough. And you can't have just a good story played out against that milieu. In order to get people's attention, we've got to have, you know, cops and robbers in it. So you have to put these two genres together, and what you wind up with is, you know, kind of silly, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. As I talk to you, you're in Florida doing what I understand is some script doctoring on a movie being made there?
That's right.
What is that movie?
Well, this is a movie called Wild Things.
Uh-huh.
It's got Matt Dillon, Kevin Bacon, Nev Campbell. It's being directed by my friend John McNaughton, who made a movie called Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer.
Sure.
Which sort of, that's his cult film, I guess.
Right. And how's that going? What's it like to be on the set of a movie doctoring a script?
Well, you know, so far it's okay. They haven't actually started shooting yet, but Mr. McNaughton is somebody that I enjoy working with quite a lot. We share similar ways of seeing the world, and, you know, we've certainly had some fun with the story. So I'm you know, it's getting to the point to where it's pretty much the ball will be in his court now, and I'm hoping that, you know, I'm hoping that he will get a good movie out of it. I think that he can.
Does that kind of writing, working on scripts, screenplays, does that sort of come with the territory as a writer in California? Is it something that you look at as a way to make money and further your time you can spend as a novelist?
Well, for a while, when I was going to school in New York, I thought that I published, you know, I sold Tapping the Source about the, you know, I got to Columbia, the writing program there, and about the first week I was in town, my agent sold the novel, and so a lot of people couldn't figure out why I was still hanging around the program, and I thought at that time that what I wanted to do was teach, and that I would, you know, through some combination of published work and an advanced degree, I would probably, you know, use some sort of teaching career to help finance the novel writing, which is, I guess, because I had known other writers that had done that. But once I actually began doing that, trying to teach, I just realized that it was something I didn't much like to do. I didn't want to put the time and energy you have to put into it to really teach full time. It wasn't feeding my work in the proper way. So I had an agent out in Hollywood at that time and was having lunch with her one day and sort of complaining about the fact that I had to teach. And she said, well, why don't you write a screenplay and then I'll sell it and you won't have to teach anymore. So I took her up on that and took a month and ground out an original screenplay, which we did manage to sell. And I've pretty much been going back and forth between the novels and the screenplay since then. That was in about 1988.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Well, thanks for having me.
That's Kem Nunn, whose new novel is called The Dogs of Winter. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu and Monique Nazareth. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. Holding down the fort for Terry Gross, I'm Ken Tucker.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.